I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. There has been a whirlwind of news in the last few weeks. The racist killings of 9 people in an historic black church in South Carolina. Calls for the removal of symbols of the Confederacy across the country, including in Baltimore. A Supreme Court decision affirming same-sex marriage as a constitutionally protected right. The High Court's affirmation of the Affordable Care Act. In the midst of this whirlwind, President Obama, widely seen just a few weeks ago as a lame duck chief executive, satisfied to make modest achievements in his second term. But events have started to cast Mr. Obama in a different light. And today we get Richard Schreiner's perspective on that. Author, presidential historian, and Lincoln scholar, Richard Schreiner joins us to talk about the Obama presidency after the news. Good afternoon and welcome to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In the second hour of today's show, a conversation with Samuel Hoy, president of the Maryland Institute College of Art, MICA, is nearing the end of his first year there at the school. We'll be talking with the president of MICA about the school's role in the revitalization of Station North, and also the role of art and artists in post-Freddie Gray Baltimore. Samuel Hoy joining us in the second hour of our show today. We'll also be hearing from Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal about the Supreme Court decision on coal-fired power plants yesterday. And also, Rona will be talking a little bit about the environmental consequences or impact of Governor Larry Hogan's decision to kill the Red Line project through Baltimore. All that in the second hour of our show. We're pleased again today to have the pleasure of conversation with one of Maryland's most erudite men, a professor of history at Washington College, whose interests range from the presidential leadership to architecture, literature, film, and economics. Richard Schreiner is an accomplished and prolific author and Lincoln scholar who joins us from time to time to give historical context, perspective to the news. And given the whirlwind of recent events, we've asked him to do that again today on the show. We'll spend part of this hour with Richard Schreiner discussing his latest book, A Unique Argument About American Monetary Policy and Reform, entitled How America Can Spend Its Way Back to Greatness. In this new book, Richard Schreiner proposes a new system of money creation that would incorporate two symbiotic money streams, the existing banking system, that's of course run by the Federal Reserve, and a new stream of money created by Congress. We'll hear about that later in this hour. Richard, nice to have you back on the show.
Oh, Dan, it's a pleasure to be here.
We start today by stopping a little bit to catch our breath over all this news. As I said, a whirlwind of news in the last few weeks, some of which we've already discussed in brief with you on the air. The racist killings of 9 people in a historic AME church in South Carolina. Calls for the removal of symbols of the Confederacy across the country, including here in Baltimore. A Supreme Court decision affirming same-sex marriage as a constitutionally protected right, the High Court's affirmation of the Affordable Care Act, again, just last week. And in the midst of that whirlwind, there's President Obama, widely seen just a few weeks ago as a lame duck chief executive, satisfied to make modest achievements in his second term. What a series of days in American life, writes David Remnick in The New Yorker, full of savage mayhem, uncommon forgiveness, resistance to forgiveness, furious debate, mourning, and finally, justice and grace. On Saturday, President Obama eulogized the Reverend Clementa Pinckney, pastor of the Emmanuel AME Church, where the horrific massacre of a Bible study group occurred on the evening of June 17th.
None of us can or should expect a transformation in race relations overnight. Every time something like this happens, somebody says, we have to have a conversation about race. We talk a lot about race. There's no shortcut. We don't need more talk. None of us should believe that a handful of gun safety measures will prevent every tragedy. It will not. People of goodwill, we'll continue to debate the merits of various policies as our democracy requires. This is a big, raucous place America is. And there are good people on both sides of these debates. Whatever solutions we find will necessarily be incomplete. But it would be a betrayal of everything Reverend Pinckney stood for, I believe, if we allowed ourselves to slip into a comfortable silence again.
You're right. And at the end of the eulogy, the coda, President Obama broke into Amazing Grace, and the nation got to hear the President of the United States sing that.
Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound.
Richard Stryner, I wonder if you give us your thoughts about President Obama at this point in his presidency, especially in light of this tragic event, and more generally, the scale of events in just the last 2 weeks, those that I mentioned.
This has been an astonishingly turbulent period in American history, the Obama era, if we might call it that. It has involved an overlap between two historical sequences of very, very long duration. One of them might be called the very long history of striving to fulfill the American promise in terms of liberty, freedom, empowerment for people, different kinds of people, all people. That is a story that has fired the imaginations of people here and all over the world since Jefferson wrote his immortal lines in the Declaration of Independence. It is a story that has proceeded unevenly and yet in many ways continuously throughout the history of our republic. And it has been applied by activists to various groups of people. Barack Obama's election as the first African-American president in American history was absolutely a milestone in this long and continuing and unfolding story as it applies to race. Other events unfolding now and events that will continue to unfold apply to issues based upon gender, issues based upon sexual preference, other issues. These are sub-stories within one long and continuing story. All right. But it just so happened that macro history in the Obama era began with the intersection of another story, an economic story, also a very, very long duration, because it just so happened that when an African-American was nominated for and elected to the presidency, the biggest economic contraction since the 1930s took place, and that new administration was stuck with the problem of dealing with it, just as Herbert Hoover's new administration became stuck within its first year with the challenge of dealing with what emerged as the Great Depression. And these two stories intersected in some fundamentally important and interactive ways. Perhaps that's a sufficiently long-winded introduction to some other remarks that I have in mind. Would you like to talk about it?
Which part? Because there's
any of it.
Any of it. All right. Let's begin with the horror of Charleston. Can I go there with you?
Of course.
The calls to take down the Confederate flag in Columbia that followed right away, and Obama's moment that we just heard of Amazing Grace there in the church. He talked about that conversation about race that we're supposed to be having, this endlessly revived and for some reviled conversation that we're supposed to have about race. And so I wonder now at this point in his presidency, do you see Obama, as David Remnick writes in The New Yorker, shedding his tendency toward caution on it? We're hearing more from him about this.
I do. Many, many people commented during the election of 2008 and its immediate aftermath on the momentous implications of Barack Obama's election. But then other events, well, I shouldn't say but then. In the process of all that, the unfolding economic crisis of 2008, which George W. Bush in the last months of his administration was forced to begin dealing with, and then Obama inherited it, preempted a lot of continuing exploration of the race issue. In my view, the economic issue during that first year began to trump all others. I'll have more to say about that in a few minutes. But the way Obama responded to the contraction, the nature of his recovery package when the Democrats still controlled Congress, the backlash that began to develop in the form of the Tea Party, in the form of the Occupy Wall Street movement, and then the convulsion 2 years into his first term when the Republicans took over the House. In many ways, and also Obama's decision to press forward with health care reform in the midst of all that, created the politics of rage and deadlock and hysteria, most of it on the right, in my judgment, that resulted in a stalemated presidency to a very, very great extent, right down to the present. And in the course of all these events, many people, including my wife, suggested to me that all of these debates about economic policy, budget deals, sequestrations, and libertarian resistance to
government. The debt ceiling, the debt
limit. Yeah, that really, to some extent, race was at the bottom of it the whole time. And I said, well, that is certainly possible. And I will tell you right now, I think that to some extent it's likely. But to what extent, I don't know. I'm a little bit skeptical that the race issue has, in fact, been secretly trumping all others this whole time. I'm very skeptical about that, but I'm willing to agree that it's probably been there.
You mean if it was a white president, a white male Democrat in the same position?
That's right. That's right. That's right.
You question whether then. But on a previous show, you and I discussed this effort to delegitimize Obama, right?
Yes, I think that's right. Now, to some extent, that is a matter of ideological and partisan savagery that has precedent in the Clinton administration during the 90s. 1993, you know, the so-called presidential honeymoon that was to some extent customary in American politics went away. I mean, the Republicans ganged up on Clinton immediately in the spring of 1993 with one filibuster after another led by Bob Dole. And the idea was to just nullify his election, and to some extent it worked because Clinton's response was on the whole so weak that in 1994 the Republicans, with their contract with America, you know, took over Congress. And that's not the first time this sort of thing has happened either. But when race was added to it, there's certainly reason for believing it intensified and made these pre-existing tendencies far more savage than they would have been otherwise. And now, having said all that, given the events of the last year, I am more prepared to say now than I might have been in the past that probably race has been a huge factor the whole time, and that now, as the presidency of this first African-American president is entering its final phases, a lot of malevolent, deep-rooted feelings are starting to get
have risen to
put
the surface.
Into hideous action.
Yeah. Okay, but look at the reaction to Charleston.
Yes.
This horror in Charleston. Because President Obama, while president, has seen other mass shootings before. A member of Congress, Gabby Gifford, shot out in Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
Mass shootings in a movie theater. Newtown.
Oh, that horror, children, you know, with all those poor little children slaughtered. Yes.
And no action from Congress, no response on guns from Congress. But nonetheless, here we have this moment in time, this shooting, which I call a racist massacre in a church in South Carolina.
That's exactly what it was.
But then following that, almost immediately calls for taking down the Confederate flag at this state capitol in Columbia and in other states in the South. And here in Baltimore, we see calls to remove Robert E. Lee's name from a public park.
Yes.
So does it surprise you that there's such a quick reaction to that? What does that say about Obama's leadership and what's going on in this country?
Yes and no. As to your question, whether it surprised me, I find history usually surprising because it's so hard to predict the way these volatile, complex forces will play out on any given day. But what's the larger issue of what's going on is that American politics in general have become so savage. We have become so deeply divided as a people We are so enraged with each other, and there's so little that can be done on the issues we all have in common because of that. This country has become more and more dysfunctional politically. And way down deep, I'm sure millions of Americans on both ends of the ideological spectrum realize that. And so one of the big questions in my mind was, how long will it take for a common sense counter-reaction to take place wherein people say things are much too far out of control on our side as well as on the other? And people of basic sanity have now got to begin coming together to do something to contain the force of this poisonous...
This partisanship? This super partisanship.
Poisonous sickness that is at large in the land. And this, I think...
Is that wishful thinking on your part, that that's going to happen? What's going to make that happen?
Well, of course, any optimism is wishful. It may or may not prove justified by events. But I don't think it's unreasonable to suppose that a lot of people might be thinking that way. I think the events of the past few weeks on many fronts show that clearly some of them have. As, for instance, within the South... The calls to take down the Confederate battle flag, the images we've seen in the press of people on both sides of this issue, you know, embracing each other, you know, during some of these protest events to show that, you know, regardless of whether we disagree on this, we, you know, we're still fellow citizens and so on. Perhaps this is linkable to the Supreme Court's moderate decisions in the past few weeks. Maybe. I don't know. My hunch is that the Chief Justice, though arguably quite conservative in many ways, has enough practical political wisdom, common sense, and so on to realize we can't give in to the far right on everything.
We'll get to that next, because I do want to talk about these recent Supreme Court decisions with Richard Striner, our guest in this hour of the show, joining us today from Washington College. And you can weigh in, too. We'd like to hear from you, your evaluation of President Obama, your thoughts, reflections, observations about his behavior and his words the last couple of weeks in the face of these events. And what do these Supreme Court decisions say to you about the Obama presidency? 410-662-8780 is our number. A short break here on Midday. We'll be right back. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here with our friend from Washington College, historian Richard Striner. One last question to follow up there on President Obama in these recent events. You know, I asked you about whether you thought he was shedding his tendency toward caution on the subject of race. The last 2 weeks, it seems like he's talked a lot about it. He spoke about it when Trayvon Martin was shot and killed in Florida. But in this first term, very careful about all that, very careful about how he addressed those topics, if at all, as the first black president. So he seems to be opening up, certainly more relaxed about that. And look at his delivery of that eulogy in Charleston on Saturday. Your thoughts about that, Richard?
I think Obama has handled the race issue perfectly during his presidency. I want to talk about race myself for a minute, even though the president said we've talked enough about it. I'm not quite sure that's true. I think we need to continue to talk about it, but look at it from different angles of vision. I've done a little bit of that myself in a book that I wrote on Lincoln and race a couple of years ago. It's, I think, very good that to some extent, to a very great extent during his presidency, Obama chose to de-emphasize race. I think it's good for several reasons. I think that it was wise because it contained the potentiality for some people to get irrational and hysterical, you know, those who have problems with race, people who are bigoted. It was wise to play it down. I think it was wise to play it down, too, and here I'm going to utter some views of my own that some may find controversial, because I myself think it's unfortunate that so much emphasis is placed on race. When I wrote that book on Lincoln and race, my editor asked me to write a preface in which I dealt with the term race, and Sometimes authors like the suggestions their editors make, sometimes not. I thought it was a wonderful suggestion. So I said, let's talk about what it means, this word. It is a label that applies to certain patterns of physical appearance that are widespread among certain population groups within the human species. These patterns are obviously inherited, and they have a lot to do with the geographical source of the ancestry of these people. Now, that is all, in my view. There have been many attempts to read into these outward physical features certain inward tendencies that have no correspondence whatsoever in my personal experience to the outward physical appearance. Back in 1937, the French-born American intellectual historian Jacques Barzun wrote a book called Race, A Study in Modern Superstition, which is, in my judgment, as wise and valid today as it was in 1937. He said, this is pseudoscience. You know, all these contentions that are made about, race, he said, it's just a word referring to patterns of physical appearance. What it means is what we choose to read into it. Beyond that, the word means nothing. People are people. People are individuals. And if some want to emphasize their race in positive ways, just as some might wish to emphasize their religious heritage in positive ways, fine, but I don't think they should be labeled and categorized because of their physical appearance.
But in this country, I mean, it's a dynamic in so much of our social life, political life in this country.
It is.
And look at the uprising against police excessive force, brutality, the killings of unarmed black men in America. That's all. Race is the super ingredient in all of that.
It certainly is. And there certainly are patterns of malevolent bigotry and hatred based upon race and race ideology and race consciousness. These are facts. And to deny these facts is stupid. They've got to be dealt with on their own terms. Except here in Baltimore, for example, the police brutality business involved issues of class, you know, as well as race. Some of the police officers were black, whether obviously, you know, well-groomed, wealthy black people here in Baltimore would receive such treatment as opposed to obviously poor blacks is an important question, too.
Why do you think it was wise for Obama to play it down then in his first term?
Well, for
not to just make matters worse, to fire up the opposition. How could you? It was so partisan anyway.
Yes, but I think he should have fought back harder, but not on the basis of race. I think he should have fought back harder on the basis of issues that we all have in common.
Let's take a call along those lines from Joseph in Baltimore. I think wants to make a point right along those lines, Richard. Joseph, welcome to Midday.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm enjoying it a lot, as I always do. And my question is, I think, and I maintain, and I'd like the guest's opinion, that the common sense wish for change has been a characteristic of the electorate for several decades now. And that, for example, Clinton was elected because people wanted change, and he had a Democratic majority. When he was very timid, they took it away from him. And the same thing happened to Obama, a big Democratic majority, and he was perceived as timid and didn't deliver what the people wanted, and they took the majority away from him and threw the Democrats out both times. So I was very, very interested to hear this guest comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, some progressives, many who supported Obama in his first term, thought he should have been even bolder. Others are satisfied that he got the Affordable Care Act passed, so.
I agree with much of what our caller just said. But when we use terms like the people, I think it's important to understand that the people in the aggregate may agree quite a lot about a great many things, but that in other ways different groups may radically differ and their own views may change based upon rapid mood swings, you know, from one day to another. I personally think that Clinton in his first year and Obama in his first year were much too timid. And that the timidity was particularly evident on economic political issues. In 1992, Clinton's informal campaign slogan was, "It's the economy, stupid," because the elder George Bush inherited a recession caused in large part by the policies of Reagan in the 80s. But anyway, Clinton capitalized on that. He should have. An economic recession should be bad news for the incumbents. They should be able to do something about it. And if they can't, they should be thrown out. All right, Clinton was put in. And he had an economic stimulus within his action package for legislation in the spring of 1993. And the Republicans filibustered it to death. There were a lot of calls from commentators for Clinton to play hardball and fight back hard, and he didn't. I think that was a big mistake. I think it rendered his presidency almost impotent within the first year. In the case of Obama, it was a much huger economic issue. I think Obama picked the wrong economic advisor, Larry Summers. I think he should have listened to people like Paul Krugman, who said the stimulus package is only a third as big as it needs to be. You're going to have one shot at this, and if you can't deliver something close to a full-fledged recovery, you are going to have one hell of a backlash. And that's exactly what happened.
Some would look at the economic crisis and Obama's effort on the Affordable Care Act, health insurance, and say, yeoman's job, well done, and thank you for that. And I've heard people say that who supported Obama, that if he accomplished nothing else, that would be significant enough. But look, I want to move on to another topic here.
Well, I'd love to talk about that for a minute, though.
Okay, go ahead. I'll let you. No, good. You get 1 minute to respond, sir.
Okay, yes and no. I mean, the Affordable Care Act is a milestone. He should be proud of it. But in strategy, there is always a question of power sequencing. And when he decided to go ahead, I thought to myself, you're making a mistake. Because if you can't deliver something close to full-fledged economic recovery, you're going to pay a huge price for putting this health care first. And I think that happened. Because when a lot of people are out of work and suffering and becoming irrational, and then you push through something complex and controversial like this health care law, you're just asking for it. The politics have taken my money, you know, and putting it where it shouldn't go.
As a historian, and me as a journalist, just love to know what the calculus was there. Who decided that? I think that probably the advice to Obama was, you better get it in the first 2 years, or you're not going to be able to get it at all.
Oh, I'm sure he received that advice, and my guess is that he probably thought so himself. I think he was wrong.
Before we move on, I wanted to ask you about the Confederate flag on public grounds and this controversy and debate that stirred. And there's a call here in Baltimore to remove the name of Robert E. Lee from a public park. Some speakers on this show, and I've seen on social media, several people say that these are just superficial efforts to address institutionalized racism. And do you see it that way, or is there a significance here that we too easily dismiss in taking down these flags?
No, I don't easily dismiss it. I think it's extremely important. Symbols can be enormously important, and the Confederate flag is a symbol of great power. Problem is that it's a symbol that connotes different things to different people. I've studied the Civil War and its origins thoroughly for a long, long time and written about it. And there is absolutely no question that the impetus towards secession came from the disputes over slavery. The South Carolina Secession Convention made it absolutely clear that the attempts by the Republicans to stop the creation of any more slave states would put the existing slave states into a position of permanent minority status, and that as a supermajority of free states got created, the requisite number of states to ratify a constitutional amendment outlawing, and that's exactly the way slavery was destroyed by the 13th Amendment, they saw that. And when Lincoln was elected and his party captured control of both houses of Congress, the most militant defenders of slavery said, game over. You know, we now go into our default setting and just repudiate the federal Constitution. South Carolina made that absolutely clear. Mississippi Secession Convention made that absolutely clear. It was the slaveholding elite that led the way. Now, there were plenty of white Southerners who opposed slavery. How many? We'll never know, because since the 1830s, almost every slave state adopted a slave code that suppressed free speech among whites on the issue of slavery. How could that be? Free country, First Amendment. Oh, read the First Amendment. It says Congress shall pass no law abridging free speech. Not until 1925 that the Supreme Court, in the case of Gitlow versus New York, applied the First Amendment to the states. Anti-slavery opinion in the white South was criminalized from the 1830s through the 1860s. We'll never know how many whites were unionist or anti-slavery. Their voices were stilled. And I firmly believe, and there's a great deal of evidence to show, that many men who served as Confederate soldiers were not pro-slavery. They didn't own slavery. But, you know, once their states had taken that action, you know, that's to some extent the case with Robert E. Lee. I don't think he was emotionally or intellectually eager to confront the issue of slavery. His Army of Northern Virginia on the march in the Antietam campaign, in the Gettysburg campaign, seized free blacks here in Maryland and sent them south into slavery. I don't know whether Lee knew about that or not. I think he was in avoidance to some extent on the issue.
For some people, Lee looms out there as separate from all that, the commander in chief of that army, but really not engaged in those issues. And I've heard this a lot.
Well, I'm not a
Lee
scholar.
Lots of rehabilitation.
I'm not a Lee scholar, so I honestly don't know whether Lee knew about the enslavement of free blacks. I mean, in the
war crimes... Well, he certainly knew
what
the war was about,
in the
as
war
you just
crimes
described
trial
it.
After World War II for the Japanese commander in the Philippines, you know, the Bataan Death March,
yeah.
His American-appointed attorneys became convinced he really didn't know. All right, chain of command issue. He should have known. He didn't. But, you know, should he be shot to death by firing squad?
The larger point is Lee knew what the war was about.
He knew what the war was about, but I think for him it finally came down to an emotional decision based upon personal and family issues. His father, Light Horse Harry Lee, abandoned the family. And Lee was the eldest son. Now, in the psychology of eldest children, many times, you know, there is a vow made, consciously or not, that when I come of age, I will never be guilty of an act like that. I think, to some extent, the idea of abandoning family, friends, kindred, state, was what made Lee's decision happen.
Richard Striner, what are your thoughts about pulling down the flags, doing away with this, maybe removing statues of Lee and Jackson, taking Lee's name off of a public park in Baltimore?
The people are free to make any decisions they deem appropriate when it comes to controversial symbols. For many, the Confederate flag is simply a part of American history. This harkens back to my work as a historic preservation activist. You know, the historical evidence of the past is there. It's a part of our cultural landscape. We learn accurately about the past from it, and so on. And yet buildings do get torn down, sometimes for defensible reasons. Changes do get made. There's a statue of Roger Taney, you know, who was Chief Justice during the Dred Scott decision in 1857 on the grounds of the Maryland State House to this day. I would love to see it removed as a citizen. As a historic preservationist, I'm not so sure.
Richard Striner joining us today from Washington College, where he's a professor of history, an accomplished author, Lincoln scholar, presidential historian. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to turn to monetary policy and Richard Striner's audacious idea, grounded in history, for a new system of money creation that would incorporate two symbiotic money streams, the existing banking system run by the Fed and a new stream of money created by Congress. How do you get up the cash the country needs to make itself truly great again? More with Richard Striner after this short break on Midday. And welcome back. Dan Rodericks here on the Midday Show, 410-662-8780. If you'd like to join our conversation or ask a question of our guest, Richard Striner, professor of history at Washington College, and author of a book I'm going to tell you about again, author of several books, but the latest is the one we'll be discussing in a minute. Before we do that, I just wonder, you know, we're certainly not at the end of the Obama presidency yet, but certainly, I guess we're past the midway point here of the second term. Can you add up the Obama achievements? I mentioned the Affordable Care Act being affirmed a couple of times by the Supreme Court now. You know, he didn't exactly lead on gay marriage. Vice President Joe Biden did that. But the president did tell the Justice Department not to enforce the now irrelevant Defense of Marriage Act. And then we had the Supreme Court decision last week on that, opening the door to Cuba, his handling of immigration policy, his efforts on climate change. I mean, you could look at all that and you could say there's a pretty good president there.
Yes, you could. My own opinion of Obama's performance is that he succeeded quite a lot in some ways. He does have some things to be very proud of. But like so many presidencies, like so many lives, you know, his term in office has been ambiguous. There has been very substantial failure, a number of key missed opportunities, a number of very bad, wrong judgments. And if he'd made different decisions, I think things might have played out in an overwhelmingly successful way down the line.
Especially on economic policy.
Especially on economic policy and health care. Because, you know, this is what-if history. You can never write the history of paths not taken. You can never prove what would have happened if such and such had been done instead of what was done. But I'll always continue to suspect that if Obama's response to the economic contraction had been strong enough in his first year to prompt a massive economic recovery, the Democrats would never have lost control of the House in 2010. With recovery accomplished, he could have gone right ahead with a strong Democratic majority in Congress to not only pass health care, but pass a much stronger health care bill than the one he got.
And perhaps immigration.
Yes, all of those things.
Could have dealt with that, too. Yeah, that's
one thing about political leaders who are arguably master strategists, leaders like Lincoln, in my opinion, is that they had not only a holistic view of things, but an instinct for temporal sequencing that put first things first and that laid things out in power terms in a sequential order that would allow them to gain an initial power advantage over their foes and then steadily expand that advantage over time while shrinking the advantages of the opposition. Ever mindful that policy and strategy must be tweaked and fine-tuned because things can go wrong, it's good to have a fallback plan and a number of contingent options. That's not the way Obama performed.
Like a great many people, I find myself appalled by the magnitude of problems crying out for remedial action in this country. And I am even more appalled by the straitjacket that our fiscal politics impose upon our once great nation. With those words, our guest in this hour of the show, Richard Schreiner, prefaces his argument for a new monetary system in the U.S., one based on an old idea that the government should produce its own money to cover the expenses that will challenge the nation in the years ahead. This is Richard's new book, How America Can Spend Its Way Back to Greatness. In this, Richard presents this unique argument about American monetary policy and reform, and he proposes this dual system that I've mentioned a couple of times already, the existing banking system run by the Fed and a new stream of money created by Congress. So, Richard, the first question would be, wait a minute. What do you mean the government creating money or Congress creating money? Doesn't the government already create money?
All right. This is a perfectly natural question to ask right up front. It's an inevitable question because most Americans, through no fault of their own, are completely in the dark about how money creation in this country evolved and changed over time and how it happens today. Most people, for reasons that are totally understandable, visualize money as cash. They visualize it in physical terms as Federal Reserve notes, currency, and coins emitted by the Mint. Mm-hmm. This is money obviously created by government. And people figure, all right, that's where our money comes from. That's half true. No, that's less than half true. It's more than half untrue.
Where does money come from?
How do the coins and currency bills get into circulation in the first place? Now, you see, if government is creating this stuff, how does it get out there into the economy? And if government is creating it, why can't government just create as much money as its programs require? Why does government have to reach out into the larger economy to bring in streams of revenue
in
the form
taxes?
Of taxes or borrowing through the sale of bonds? That's deficit spending. If government is creating the money in the first place, and the reason is government is not creating the money in the first place. The money, the legal tender that we visualize for good reason as cash is an afterthought in the actuality of money creation. Give me one more minute to develop this point because it's basic. The fact is that our money supply is created by banks. Not only what economists call central bank money created at the top by the Federal Reserve System, but what economists also called endogenous money, which means that every time a commercial bank makes a loan, it is creating the money that it lends. That sounds impossible to believe. It sounds outrageous. It sounds like lots of things. How this happened is a story too long for me to tell now. But for anyone who wants proof, I urge you to simply get on Google, type the phrase fractional reserve banking into the search engine and see what happens. It's a fact. Our money comes from banks. And it is banks that are creating the money and the cash that government sends to banks, not to us. The banks purchase it for the use of customers who wish to draw out their liquid funds and spend them in a cash form. Increasingly rare nowadays. It's electronic. Most, 90, 95% of global transactions are done through instantaneous digital electronic data that runs in streams. Very few cash transactions anymore. But it's an afterthought.
Correct.
It's chump change.
Okay, okay. And you say cash and currency is just a convenience, really, right?
In today's monetary world, that's right.
Okay. So I hold a $10 bill in my hand, and it means something to me. It means something to the person I'm going to give it to in return for lunch or something, right?
Certainly does.
You can't just create it out of thin air. You can't, as an act of Congress, just create more money, can you?
The banks are creating it out of thin air every day. They are. They absolutely are.
Let me give this quote. In 2009, this is from your book. You cite
this. I'm so glad. And give the other one as well from 1939.
Okay. It's Scott Pelley on CBS. He's interviewing the Fed chairman, Ben Bernanke. At the time, to state the cost to taxpayers of the money that the Fed Reserve was using to prop up the banks, right? Too big to fail, right?
Right.
Bernanke said, well, it's not tax money. The banks have accounts with the Fed, so to lend to a bank, we simply use the computer to mark up the size of the account that they have with the Fed. It's much more akin to printing money. And then Scott Pelley says, you've been printing money? And Bernanke says, well, effectively.
Now, read the other one.
Okay, this is from 1939. Richard went and looked this up. The Federal Reserve produced a guidebook called The Federal Reserve System, Its Purposes and Functions. And the book included the following statement, quote, Federal Reserve bank credit does not consist of funds that the reserve authorities get somewhere in order to lend, but constitute funds that they are empowered to create.
That's right.
Well, what is the creation based on? It used to be based on gold, right?
Well, long, long ago, cash was the source of the money supply because the mint operated on the basis of what used to be called free and unlimited coinage, which meant, and this was provided for in the United States Mint Act of 1792, any citizen possessing gold or silver in the form of bullion could take that bullion, that metal, to the mint, where it would be melted down, stamped into standard measure coins, and given back. That's how it entered circulation. And then it could be deposited in banks. All right. In those days, cash, solid gold and silver coin, was the source of the money supply, and then banks extended that through the hocus-pocus of banknotes and later checking accounts. I haven't the time to explain that. But in the 20th century, the process became completely inverted, especially after the Gold Reserve Act of 1935, which ended gold coinage.
Right.
In 1965, no precious metal in coins emitted by the mint, except for special commemorative pieces that collectors can buy. But otherwise, you know, mm-hmm. the precious metal.
It's all gone.
It's all gone.
Right.
It's chump change. It's an afterthought. The stuff is sold to banks for the use of their customers when they want to make cash purchases, but how many cash purchases are made anymore?
So you argue that for the big bills coming up, like the nation dealing with its infrastructure, I don't know, climate change, getting water to California.
Yes.
The big, big
all
problems,
public necessities.
Right, right. You're saying Congress should create money.
Congress should empower itself to create money. Now, you see, for a long time, on and off, government in America did create money directly. This goes all the way back to the 1720s in colonial Pennsylvania, when Ben Franklin and others thought up the idea of the colonial government simply creating its own money and lending it into circulation.
And then after the Civil War, the greenbacks.
Well, during the Civil War.
During the Civil War.
Legal Tender Act of 1862. That's right. Now, these were sort of government IOUs. On the front of each note, it said the United States will pay. mm-hmm. Meaning, but in the meantime, it's legal tender. You can't refuse to accept it. But then after the Civil War, a number of greenbackers, monetary mavericks, said, why should they be redeemed? Why shouldn't we simply be able to create legal tender money and spend it straight into circulation? Now, this has been the path not taken. In the 1890s, in 1894, during the worst depression yet in American history, a Maverick, Ohio businessman named Jacob Coxey led thousands of unemployed men to Grover Cleveland's Washington with a proposed good roads bill of $500 million that would put the unemployed to work paving roads. And it would not cost the taxpayers anything because it would be financed by brand new money created by the government. The idea wasn't adopted. In 1934, economist John R. Commons proposed the same thing to FDR in Congress. It wasn't done. The existing method of bank-created money continued to be used, and so it was that during World War II, for example, the money supply of the United States was doubled by the Federal Reserve, creating money out of thin air, lending it through the banking system to provide the monetary base that people used to buy war bonds.
Okay. Question, Professor Stroiner.
Yes, sir.
Not cost taxpayers anything. What about debt? It sounds like you're just creating a massive amount of debt for the government.
Absolutely not. It would not be a debt obligation. It would not be lent into circulation. It would not have to be repaid, let alone with interest. Now,
It would just be circulating.
It would be brand new money created by the government, ordained and established by us, the people, and spent directly into existence.
What stands behind it?
Well, in legal terms, right now, what stands behind it is an 1871 Supreme Court decision in the case of Knox versus Lee, in which the constitutionality of the Legal Tender Act of 1862 was challenged, and the Supreme Court upheld it as constitutional. That's what stands behind it. But what also stands behind it is the manifest demonstrable success of direct government sovereign money creation on a number of occasions when it has been tried and used. Now, there have been times when this method did lead to inflation, serious inflation, and that is the first argument against it raised by the Orthodox, Confederate money.
Right. Yeah, look what happened there.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, inflation is a genuine and significant issue. There is no question about that. And our primary means of preventing or curing inflation now depends upon the regime of bank-created money run by the Federal Reserve. That was how Paul Volcker and the Fed eradicated the inflation of the 70s, by tightening up the money supply.
So you would have these two systems. The Fed would continue to do what it does with
yes.
banks, but Congress would pay its bills, our bills, by creating more money.
Well, preliminarily, some bills. Now, you see, what makes my proposal different from any other heretical maverick monetary proposal advanced to date is that, so far as I can tell, I've been the first one to propose a both-and instead of an either-or choice, because most greenbackers have been zealous, outraged crusaders against bank-created money.
Right.
They say it's a fraud, it's a scam, it's a racket, it is just downright wrong, and banks should be stripped of their power to create money. Only the government ordained and established by us, the people, should be permitted to do it. That's where I'm different. I say, why presuppose an all-or-nothing choice? Why not both? I propose two streams of electronic monetary energy, one coming from the banking system, one coming from Congress. These two streams would converge and overlap in the banking system, because that's how Uncle Sam pays anybody anything, direct electronic deposits into the bank accounts of government employees or vendors.
Hmm.
Once the new government money is in the banking system, the Fed can manipulate it to counteract inflation. And I suggest that we start real small. Trial and error. Be very cautious. Have Congress create just a little bit and see what happens. Probably nothing bad will happen, but if something bad does happen, it wouldn't take much to fix it, because the stakes have been kept deliberately small. And if it works, then expand the stakes of the experiment.
This is really interesting. We're going to devote some more time to Richard Stroiner's book, How America Can Spend Its Way Back to Greatness. Prager is the publisher
yes.
of this book. This is Richard's latest one. So we're going to continue this conversation about these two systems and having the government create money to pay its big bills coming up at a future date. But I appreciate you being here today, Richard.
Oh, it's always a pleasure,
yeah,
Dan.
Same here. Thank you very much. Richard Stroiner, professor of history at Washington College over there in Chestertown, also the author of Father Abraham, Lincoln's Relentless Struggle to End Slavery, Lincoln's Way, How Six Great Presidents Created American Power, and the book we talked about last year on Woodrow Wilson, Woodrow Wilson and World War I, A Burden Too Great to Bear. The latest one, again, is How America Can Spend Its Way Back to Greatness. More information about that is on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, and we will follow up. Thank you again, Richard. And we'll be back for another hour of Midday after the news coming up here from NPR. And for the moment, we take a break for lunch from the Bagby Pizza Company. Located in the historic Bagby Building near Harbor East, the Bagby Pizza Company offers brick oven thin crust pizza, sandwiches, pastas, salads that are made fresh daily. Open daily, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. with delivery nightly from 5 to 9 p.m. Bagby Pizza Company.